can't do what you're asking for.
What do you think I'm asking?
That I slap your face.
Why don't you?
I can't pretend an anger I don't feel, said Rourke. It's not pity. It's much more cruel than anything I could do. Only I'm not doing it in order to be cruel. If I slapped your face, you'd forgive me for the Stoddard Temple.
It is you who should seek forgiveness?
No. You wish I did. You know that there's an act of forgiveness involved. You're not clear about the actors. You wish I would forgive you, or demand payment, which is the same thing. And you believe that that would close the record. But you see, I've nothing to do with it. I'm not one of the actors. It doesn't matter what I do or feel about it now. You're not thinking of me. I can't help you. I'm not the person you're afraid of just now.
Who is?
Yourself.
Who gave you the right to say all this?
You did.
Well, go on.
Do you wish the rest?
Go on.
I think it hurts you to know that you've made me suffer. You wish you hadn't. And yet there's something that frightens you more. The knowledge that I haven't suffered at all.
Go on.
The knowledge that I'm neither kind nor generous now, but simply indifferent. It frightens you because you know that things like the Stoddard Temple always require payment, and you see that I'm not paying for it. You were astonished that I accepted this commission. Do you think my acceptance required courage? You needed far greater courage to hire me. You see, this is what I think of the Stoddard Temple. I'm through with it. You're not.
Wynand let his fingers fall open, palms out. His shoulders sagged a little, relaxing. He said very simply,
"All right. It's true. All of it."
Then he stood straight, but with a kind of quiet resignation, as if his body were consciously made vulnerable.
"I hope you know you've given me a beating in your own way," he said. "Yes, and you've taken it. So you've accomplished what you wanted. Shall we say we're even and forget the Stoddard Temple?"
"You're very wise, or I've been very obvious. Either is your achievement. Nobody's ever caused me to become obvious before."
"Shall I still do what you want?"
"What do you think I want now?"
"Personal recognition from me. It's my turn to give in, isn't it?"
"You're appallingly honest, aren't you?"
"Why shouldn't I be? I can't give you the recognition of having made me suffer. But you'll take the substitute of having given me pleasure, won't you?" "All right, then. I'm glad you like me. I think you know this is as much an exception for me as you're taking a beating. I don't usually care whether I'm liked or not. I do care this time. I'm glad."
Wynand laughed aloud.
"You're as innocent and presumptuous as an emperor. When you confer honors, you merely exalt yourself. What in hell made you think I liked you?"
"Now you don't want any explanations of that. You've reproached me once for causing you to be obvious."
Wynand sat down on a fallen tree trunk. He said nothing, but his movement was an invitation and a demand. Rourke sat down beside him. Rourke's face was sober, but the trace of a smile remained, amused and watchful, as if every word he heard were not a disclosure, but a confirmation.
"You've come up from nothing, haven't you?" Wynand asked. "You came from a poor family."
"Yes. How did you know that?"
"Just because it feels like a presumption. The thought of handing you anything, a compliment, an idea, or a fortune." "I started at the bottom, too." "Who was your father?"
"A steel puddler."
"Mine was a longshoreman." "Did you hold all sorts of funny jobs when you were a child?"
"All sorts. Mostly in the building trades."
"I did worse than that. I did just about everything."
"What job did you like best?"
"Catching rivets on steel structures." "I liked being a bootblack on a Hudson ferry. I should have hated that, but I didn't. I don't remember the people at all. I remember the city. The city, always there on the shore, spread out, waiting. As if I were tied to it by a rubber band. The band would stretch and carry me away to the other shore, but it would always snap back, and I would return.
It gave me the feeling that I'd never escape from that city, and it would never escape from me.
Rourke knew that Wynand seldom spoke of his childhood by the quality of his words. They were bright and hesitant, untarnished by usage, like coins that had not passed through many hands.
"Were you ever actually homeless and starving?" Wynand asked.
"A few times."
"Did you mind that?"
"No.
I didn't either. I minded something else. Did you want to scream when you were a child, seeing nothing but fat ineptitude around you, knowing how many things could be done and done so well but having no power to do them, having no power to blast the empty skulls around you, having to take orders, and that's bad enough, but to take orders from your inferiors. Have you felt that?"
"Yes."
"Did you drive the anger back inside of you and store it? And decide to let yourself be torn to pieces if necessary, but reach the day when you'd rule those people, and all people, and everything around you?"
"No."
"You didn't? You let yourself forget?"
"No. I hate incompetence. I think it's probably the only thing I do hate. But it didn't make me want to rule people, nor to teach them anything. It made me want to do my own work in my own way. And let myself be torn to pieces, if necessary."
"And you were?"
"No. Not in any way that counts."
"You don't mind looking back? At anything?"
"No."
"I do. There was one night. I was beaten, and I crawled to a door. I remember the pavement. It was right under my nostrils. I can still see it. There were veins in the stone and white spots. I had to make sure that the pavement moved. I couldn't feel whether I was moving or not, but I could tell by the pavement. I had to see that those veins and spots changed. I had to reach the next pattern, or the crack 6 inches away. It took a long time. And I knew it was blood under my stomach."
His voice had no tone of self-pity. It was simple, impersonal, with a faint sound of wonder. Rourke said,
"I'd like to help you."
Wynand smiled slowly, not gaily.
"I believe you could. I even believe that it would be proper. 2 days ago I would have murdered anyone who'd think of me as an object for help. You know, of course, that that night's not what I hate in my past, not what I dread to look back on. It was only the least offensive to mention. The other things can't be talked about."
"I know. I meant the other things."
"What are they? You name them."
"The Stoddard Temple."
"You want to help me with that?"
"Yes."
"You're a damn fool. Don't you realize?"
"Don't you realize I'm doing it already?"
"How?"
"By building this house for you."
Rourke saw the slanting ridges on Wynan's forehead. Wynan's eyes seemed whiter than usual, as if the blue had ebbed from the iris, two white ovals luminous on his face. He said,
"And getting a fat commission check for it."
He saw Rourke's smile, suppressed before it appeared fully. The smile would have said that this sudden insult was a declaration of surrender, more eloquent than the speeches of confidence. The suppression said that Rourke would not help him over this particular moment.
"Why, of course," said Rourke calmly.
Wynand got up.
"Let's go, we're wasting time. I have more important things to do at the office."
They did not speak on their way back to the city. Wynand drove his car at 90 miles an hour. The speed made two solid walls of blurred motion on the sides of the road, as if they were flying down a long, closed, silent corridor. He stopped at the entrance to the Cord building and let Rourke out. He said,
"You're free to go back to that site as often as you wish, Mr. Rourke. I don't have to go with you. You can get the surveys and all the information you need from my office. Please do not call on me again until it is necessary. I should be very busy. Let me know when the first drawings are ready."
When the drawings were ready, Rourke telephoned Wynand's office. He had not spoken to Wynand for a month.
"Please hold the wire, Mr. Rourke," said Wynand's secretary.
He waited. The secretary's voice came back and informed him that Mr. Wynand wished the drawings brought to his office that afternoon. She gave the hour. Wynand would not answer in person.
When Rourke entered the office, Wynand said, "How do you do, Mr. Rourke?" His voice gracious and formal. No memory of intimacy remained on his blank, courteous face. Rourke handed him the plans of the house and a large perspective drawing. Wynand studied each sheet. He held the drawing for a long time. Then he looked up.
"I am very much impressed, Mr. Rourke."
The voice was offensively correct.
"I have been quite impressed by you from the first. I have thought it over, and I want to make a special deal with you."
His glance was directed at Rourke with a soft emphasis, almost with tenderness, as if he were showing that he wished to treat Rourke cautiously, to spare him intact for a purpose of his own. He lifted the sketch and held it up between two fingers, letting the light hit it straight on. The white sheet glowed as a reflector for a moment, pushing the black pencil lines eloquently forward.
"You want to see this house erected?" Wynand asked softly. "You want it very much?"
"Yes," said Rourke.
Wynand did not move his hand, only parted his fingers and let the cardboard drop face down on the desk.
"It will be erected, Mr. Rourke, just as you designed it, just as it stands on this sketch. On one condition."
Rourke sat leaning back, his hands in his pockets, attentive, waiting.
"You don't want to ask me what condition, Mr. Rourke? Very well, I'll tell you. I shall accept this house on condition that you accept the deal I offer you. I wish to sign a contract whereby you will be the sole architect for any building I undertake to erect in the future. As you realize, this would be quite an assignment. I venture to say I control more structural work than any other single person in the country. Every man in your profession has wanted to be known as my exclusive architect. I am offering it to you. In exchange, you will have to submit yourself to certain conditions. Before I name them, I'd like to point out some of the consequences, should you refuse. As you may have heard, I do not like to be refused. The power I hold can work two ways. It would be easy for me to arrange that no commission be available to you anywhere in this country. You have a small following of your own, but no prospective employer can withstand the kind of pressure I'm in a position to exert. You have gone through wasted periods of your life before. They were nothing compared to the blockade I can impose. You might have to go back to a granite quarry. Oh, yes, I know about that. Summer of 1928, the Francone Quarry in Connecticut. How? Private detectives, Mr. Rourke. You might have to go back to a granite quarry. Only, I shall see to it that the quarries also will be closed to you. Now I'll tell you what I want of you." In all the gossip about Gale Wynand, no one had ever mentioned the expression of his face as it was in this moment. The few men who had seen it did not talk about it. Of these men, Dwight Carson had been the first. Wynand's lips were parted, his eyes brilliant. It was an expression of sensual pleasure derived from agony. The agony of his victim, or his own, or both. "I want you to design all my future commercial structures, as the public wishes commercial structures to be designed. You'll build colonial houses, rococo hotels, and semi-Grecian office buildings. You'll exercise your matchless ingenuity within forms chosen by the taste of the people. And you'll make money for me. You'll take your spectacular talent and make it obedient, originality and subservience together. They call it harmony. You'll create in your sphere what the banner is in mine. Do you think it took no talent to create the banner? Such will be your future career. But the house you've designed for me shall be erected as you designed it. It will be the last Rourke building to rise on earth. Nobody will have one after mine. You've read about ancient rulers who put to death the architect of their palace that no others might equal the glory he had given them. They killed the architect or cut his eyes out. Modern methods are different. For the rest of your life, you'll obey the will of the majority. I shan't attempt to offer you any arguments. I'm merely stating an alternative. You're the kind of man who can understand plain language. You have a simple choice. If you refuse, you'll never build anything again. If you accept, you'll build this house, which you want so much to see erected, and a great many other houses, which you won't like, but which will make money for both of us. For the rest of your life, you'll design rental developments, such as Stonebridge. That is what I want."
He leaned forward, waiting for one of the reactions he knew well and enjoyed. a look of anger, or indignation, or ferocious pride.
"Why, of course," said Rourke gaily. "I'll be glad to do it. That's easy."
He reached over, took a pencil and the first piece of paper he saw on Winan's desk, a letter with an imposing letterhead. He drew rapidly on the back of the letter. The motion of his hand was smooth and confident. Winand looked at his face bent over the paper. He saw the unwrinkled forehead, the straight line of the eyebrows, attentive, but untroubled by effort. Rourke raised his head and threw the paper to Winand across the desk.
"Is this what you want?"
Winand's house stood drawn on the paper. With colonial porches, a gambrel roof, two massive chimneys, a few little pilasters, a few porthole windows. It was not a parody. It was a serious job of adaptation in what any professor would have called excellent taste.
"Good God, no!"
The gasp was instinctive and immediate.
"Then shut up," said Rourke. "And don't ever let me hear any architectural suggestions."
Winand slumped down in his chair and laughed. He laughed for a long time, unable to stop. It was not a happy sound. Rourke shook his head wearily.
"You knew better than that. And it's such an old one to me. My antisocial stubbornness is so well known that I didn't think anyone would waste time trying to tempt me again. Howard, I meant it. Until I saw this. I knew you meant it. I didn't think you could be such a fool."
"You knew you were taking a terrible kind of chance?"
"None at all. I had an ally I could trust."
"What? Your integrity?"
"Yours, Gale."
Winand sat looking down at the surface of his desk. After a while, he said,
"You're wrong about that." "I don't think so."
Winand lifted his head. He looked tired. He sounded indifferent.
"It was your method of the Stoddard trial again, wasn't it? The defense rests. I wish I'd been in the courtroom to hear that sentence. You did throw the trial back at me again, didn't you?"
"Call it that."
"But this time you won. I suppose you know I'm not glad that you won."
"I know you're not."
"Don't think it was one of those temptations. When you tempt just to test your victim and are happy to be beaten and smile and say, 'Well, at last, here's the kind of man I want.' Don't imagine that. Don't make that excuse for me."
"I'm not. I know what you wanted."
"I wouldn't have lost so easily before. This would have been only the beginning. I know I can try further." "I don't want to try. Not because you'd probably hold out to the end, but because I wouldn't hold out. No, I'm not glad, and I'm not grateful to you for this. But it doesn't matter."
"Gale, how much lying to yourself are you actually capable of?"
"I'm not lying. Everything I just told you is true. I thought you understood it."
"Everything you just told me? Yes. I wasn't thinking of that."
"You're wrong in what you're thinking. You're wrong in remaining here."
"Do you wish to throw me out?"
"You know I can't."
Winan's glance moved from Rourke to the drawing of the house lying face down on his desk. He hesitated for a moment, looking at the blank cardboard, then turned it over. He asked softly,
"Shall I tell you now what I think of this?"
"You've told me."
"Howard, you spoke about a house as a statement of my life. Do you think my life deserves a statement like this?"
"Yes."
"Is this your honest judgment?"
"My honest judgment, Gale. My most sincere one. My final one. No matter what might happen between us in the future."
Winand put the drawing down and sat studying the plans for a long time. When he raised his head, he looked calm and normal.
"Why did you stay away from here?" he asked.
"You were busy with private detectives."
Winand laughed. "Oh, that. I couldn't resist my old bad habits, and I was curious. Now I know everything about you, except the women in your life. Either you've been very discreet, or there haven't been many.
No information available on that anywhere.
There haven't been many.
I think I missed you. It was a kind of substitute, gathering the details of your past.
Why did you actually stay away?
You told me to.
Are you always so meek about taking orders?
When I find it advisable.
Well, here's an order. Hope you place it among the advisable ones. Come to have dinner with us tonight. I'll take this drawing home to show my wife. I've told her nothing about the house so far.
You haven't told her?
No. I want her to see this. And I want you to meet her. I know she hasn't been kind to you in the past. I read what she wrote about you. But it's so long ago. I hope it doesn't matter now.
No, it doesn't matter.
Then will you come?
Yes. Chapter 4. Dominique stood at the glass door of her room. Wynand saw the starlight on the ice sheets on the roof garden outside. He saw its reflection touching the outline of her profile, a faint radiance on her eyelids, on the planes of her cheeks. He thought that this was the illumination proper to her face. She turned to him slowly, and the light became an edge around the pale straight mass of her hair. She smiled, as she had always smiled at him, a quiet greeting of understanding.
"What's the matter, Gale?"
"Good evening, dear."
"Why?" "You look happy. That's not the word, but it's the nearest."
"Light is nearer. I feel light. 30 years lighter. Not that I'd want to be what I was 30 years ago. One never does. But the feeling means is only a sense of being carried back intact, as one is now, back to the beginning. It's quite illogical and impossible and wonderful."
"What the feeling usually means is that you've met someone. A woman, as a rule."
"I have. Not a woman. A man. Dominique, you're very beautiful tonight." "But I always say that. It's not what I wanted to say. It's this. I am very happy tonight that you're so beautiful."
"What is it, Gale?"
"Nothing. Only a feeling of how much is unimportant and how easy it is to live." He took her hand and held it to his lips. "Dominique, I've never stopped thinking it's a miracle that our marriage has lasted. Now I believe that it won't be broken by anything or anyone." She leaned back against the glass pane. "I have a present for you. Don't remind me, it's a sentence I use more often than any other. I will have a present for you by the end of this summer. Our house."
"The house? You haven't spoken of it for so long, I thought you had forgotten."
"I've thought of nothing else for the last 6 months." "You haven't changed your mind? You do want to move out of the city?"
"Yes, Gale, if you want it so much." "Have you decided on an architect?"
"I've done more than that. I have the drawing of the house to show you."
"Oh, I'd like to see it."
"It's in my study." "Come on, I want you to see it."
She smiled and closed her fingers over his wrist, a brief pressure like a caress of encouragement. Then she followed him. He threw the door of his study open and let her enter first. The light was on, and the drawing stood propped on his desk facing the door. She stopped, her hands behind her, palms flattened against the door jamb. She was too far away to see the signature, but she knew the work, and the only man who could have designed that house. Her shoulders moved, describing a circle, twisting slowly, as if she were tied to a pole and abandoned hope of escape, and only her body made a last instinctive gesture of protest. She thought, were she lying in bed in Rourke's arms in the sight of Gale Wynand, the violation would be less terrible. This drawing, more personal than Rourke's body, created in answer to a matching force that came from Gale Wynand, was a violation of her, of Rourke, of Wynand. And yet she knew suddenly that it was the inevitable.
"No," she whispered. "Things like that are never a coincidence."
"What?"
But she held up her hand, softly pushing back all conversation, and she walked to the drawing, her steps soundless on the carpet. She saw the sharp signature in the corner. Howard Rourke. It was less terrifying than the shape of the house. It was a thin point of support, almost a greeting.
"Dominique?"
She turned her face to him. He saw her answer.
he said. I knew you'd like it. Forgive the inadequacy. We're stuck for words tonight. She walked to the davenport and sat down. She let her back press against the cushions. It helped to sit straight. She kept her eyes on Wynand. He stood before her, leaning on the mantelpiece, half turned away, looking at the drawing. She could not escape that drawing. Wynand's face was like a mirror of it.
You've seen him, Gale?
Whom?
The architect?
Of course I've seen him. Not an hour ago.
When did you first meet him?
Last month.
You knew him all this time? Every evening, when you came home, at the dinner table.
You mean why didn't I tell you? I wanted to have the sketch to show you. I saw the house like this, but I couldn't explain it. I didn't think anyone would ever understand what I wanted and design it. He did.
Who?
Howard Rourke. She had wanted to hear the name pronounced by Gale Wynand.
How did you happen to choose him, Gale?
I looked all over the country. Every building I liked had been done by him. She nodded slowly. Dominique, I take it for granted you don't care about it anymore, but I know that I picked the one architect you spent all your time denouncing when you were on the banner.
You read that?
I read it. You had an odd way of doing it. It was obvious that you admired his work and hated him personally. But you defended him at the Stoddard trial.
Yes.
You even worked for him once. That statue, Dominique, it was made for his temple.
Yes.
It's strange. You lost your job on the banner for defending him. I didn't know it when I chose him. I didn't know about that trial. I'd forgotten his name. Dominique, in a way, it's he who gave you to me. That statue, from his temple. And now he's going to give me this house. Dominique, why did you hate him?
I didn't hate him. It was so long ago.
I suppose none of that matters now, does it? He pointed to the drawing.
I haven't seen him for years.
You're going to see him in about an hour. He's coming here for dinner. She moved her hand, tracing a spiral on the arm of the davenport, to convince herself that she could.
Here?
Yes.
You've asked him for dinner?
He smiled. He remembered his resentment against the presence of guests in their house. He said, This is different. I want him here. I don't think you remember him well, or you wouldn't be astonished. She got up.
All right, Gale, I'll give the orders. Then I'll get dressed.
They faced each other across the drawing room of Gale Wynand's penthouse. She thought how simple it was. He had always been here. He had been the motive power of every step she had taken in these rooms. He had brought her here, and now he had come to claim this place. She was looking at him. She was seeing him as she had seen him on the morning when she awakened in his bed for the last time. She knew that neither his clothes nor the years stood between her and the living intactness of that memory. She thought that this had been inevitable from the first, from the instant when she had looked down at him on the ledge of a quarry. It had to come like this, in Gale Wynand's house. And now she felt the peace of finality, knowing that her share of decision had ended. She had been the one who acted. But he would act from now on. She stood straight, her head level. The planes of her face had a military cleanliness of precision and a feminine fragility. Her hands hung still, composed by her sides, parallel with the long straight lines of her black dress.
How do you do, Mr. Rourke?
How do you do, Mrs. Wynand?
May I thank you for the house you have designed for us? It's the most beautiful of your buildings.
It had to be by the nature of the assignment, Mrs. Wynand.
She turned her head slowly.
How did you present the assignment to Mr. Rourke, Gale?
Just as I spoke of it to you.
She thought of what Rourke had heard from Wynand, and had accepted. She moved to sit down. The two men followed her example. Rourke said,
If you like the house, the first achievement was Mr. Wynand's conception of it.
She asked,
Are you sharing the credit with a client?
Yes, in a way.
I believe this contradicts what I remember of your professional convictions.
But supports my personal ones.
I'm not sure I ever understood that.
I believe in conflict, Mrs. Wynand.
Was there a conflict involved in designing this house?
The desire not to be influenced by my client.
In what way?
I have liked working for some people and did not like working for others, but neither mattered. This time I knew that the house would be what it became only because it was being done for Mr. Wynand. I had to overcome this. Or rather, I had to work with it and against it. It was the best way of working. The house had to surpass the architect, the client, and the future tenant. It did.
But the house. It's you, Howard, said Wynand. It's still you.
It was the first sign of emotion on her face, a quiet shock when she heard the Howard. Wynand did not notice it. Rourke did. He glanced at her, his first glance of personal contact. She could read no comment in it, only a conscious affirmation of the thought that had shocked her.
Thank you for understanding that, Gale, he answered.
She was not certain whether she had heard him stressing the name.
It's strange, said Wynand. I'm the most offensively possessive man on earth. I do something to things. Let me pick up an ashtray from a dime store counter, pay for it, and put it in my pocket, and it becomes a special kind of ashtray, unlike any on earth, because it's mine. It's an extra quality in the thing, like a sort of halo. I feel that about everything I own, from my overcoat, to the oldest linotype in the composing room, to the copies of the banner on newsstands, to this penthouse, to my wife. And I've never wanted to own anything as much as I want this house you're going to build for me, Howard. I will probably be jealous of Dominique living in it. I can be quite insane about things like that. And yet, I don't feel that I'll own it, because no matter what I do or pay, it's still yours. It will always be yours.
It has to be mine, said Rourke. But in another sense, Gale, you own that house and everything else I've built. You own every structure you've stopped before and heard yourself answering.
In what sense?
In the sense of that personal answer. What you feel in the presence of a thing you admire is just one word. Yes, the affirmation, the acceptance, the sign of admittance. And that yes is more than an answer to one thing. It's a kind of amen to life, to the earth that holds this thing, to the thought that created it, to yourself for being able to see it. But the ability to say yes or no is the essence of all ownership. It's your ownership of your own ego, your soul, if you wish. Your soul has a single basic function, the act of valuing. Yes or no, I wish or I do not wish. You can't say yes without saying I. There's no affirmation without the one who affirms. In this sense, everything to which you grant your love is yours.
In this sense, you share things with others?
No, it's not sharing. When I listen to a symphony I love, I don't get from it what the composer got. His yes was different from mine. He could have no concern for mine, and no exact conception of it. That answer is too personal to each man. But in giving himself what he wanted, he gave me a great experience. I'm alone when I design a house, Gale, and you can never know the way in which I own it. But if you said your own amen to it, it's also yours. And I'm glad it's yours.
Wynand said, smiling, I like to think that I own Monadnock and the Enright House, and the Cord Building, and the Stoddard Temple, said Dominique. She had listened to them. She felt numb. Wynand had never spoken like this to any guest in their house. Rourke had never spoken like this to any client. She knew that the numbness would break into anger, denial, indignation later. Now it was only a cutting sound in her voice. A sound to destroy what she had heard. She thought that she succeeded. Wynand answered, the word dropping heavily.
Yes. Forget the Stoddard Temple, Gale, said Rourke.
There was such a simple, careless gaiety in his voice that no solemn dispensation could have been more effective.
Yes, Howard, said Wynand, smiling.
She saw Rourke's eyes turn to her.
I have not thanked you, Mrs. Wynand, for accepting me as your architect. I know that Mr. Wynand chose me, and you could have refused my services. I wanted to tell you that I'm glad you didn't.
She thought, I believe it, because none of this can be believed. I'll accept anything tonight. I'm looking at him.
She said, courteously indifferent, "Wouldn't it be a reflection on my judgment to suppose that I would wish to reject a house you had designed, Mr. Rourke?" She thought that nothing she said aloud could matter tonight.
Wynand asked,
"Howard, that yes, once granted, can it be withdrawn?" She wanted to laugh in incredulous anger. It was Wynand's voice that had asked this. It should have been hers.
"He must look at me when he answers," she thought. "He must look at me."
"Never," Rourke answered, looking at Wynand.
"There's so much nonsense about human inconstancy and the transience of all emotions," said Wynand. "I've always thought that a feeling which changes never existed in the first place. There are books I liked at the age of 16. I still like them."
The butler entered carrying a tray of cocktails. Holding her glass, she watched Rourke take his off the tray. She thought, "At this moment the glass stem between his fingers feels just like the one between mine. We have this much in common."
Wynand stood holding a glass, looking at Rourke with a strange kind of incredulous wonder, not like a host, like an owner who cannot quite believe his ownership of his prized possession. She thought, "I'm not insane. I'm only hysterical. But it's quite all right. I'm saying something. I don't know what it is, but it must be all right. They are both listening and answering. Gale is smiling. I must be saying the proper things."
Dinner was announced, and she rose obediently. She led the way to the dining room, like a graceful animal given poise by conditioned reflexes. She sat at the head of the table between the two men facing each other at her sides. She watched the silverware in Rourke's fingers, the pieces of polished metal with the initials D.W. She thought, "I've done this so many times. I'm the gracious Mrs. Gale Wynand." They were senators, judges, presidents of insurance companies, sitting at dinner in that place at my right. And this is what I was being trained for. This is why Gale has been rising through tortured years to the position of entertaining senators and judges at dinner, for the purpose of reaching an evening when the guest facing him would be Howard Rourke.
Wynand spoke about the newspaper business. He showed no reluctance to discuss it with Rourke, and she pronounced a few sentences when it seemed necessary. Her voice had a luminous simplicity. She was being carried along, unresisting. Any personal reaction would be superfluous, even pain or fear. She thought, if in the flow of conversation Wynand's next sentence should be, "You've slept with him," she would answer, "Yes, Gale, of course," just as simply. But Wynand seldom looked at her. When he did, she knew by his face that hers was normal. Afterward they were in the drawing room again, and she saw Rourke standing at the window against the lights of the city. She thought Gale built this place as a token of his own victory, to have the city always before him, the city where he did run things at last. But this is what it had really been built for, to have Rourke stand at that window. And I think Gale knows it tonight. Rourke's body blocking miles out of that perspective, with only a few dots of fire and a few cubes of lighted glass left visible around the outline of his figure. He was smoking, and she watched his cigarette moving slowly against the black sky as he put it between his lips, then held it extended in his fingers, and she thought, "They are only sparks from his cigarette, those points glittering in space behind him." She said softly, "Gale always liked to look at the city at night. He was in love with skyscrapers." Then she noticed she had used the past tense, and wondered why. She did not remember what she said when they spoke about the new house. Wynand brought the drawings from his study, spread the plans on a table, and the three of them stood bent over the plans together. Rourke's pencil moved, pointing across the hard geometrical patterns of thin black lines on white sheets. She heard his voice, close to her, explaining. They did not speak of beauty and affirmation, but of closets, stairways, pantries, bathrooms. Rourke asked her whether she found the arrangements convenient. She thought it was strange that they all spoke as if they really believed she would ever live in this house. When Rourke had gone, she heard Wynand asking her,
What do you think of him?
She felt something angry and dangerous, like a single sudden twist within her, and she said, half in fear, half in deliberate invitation,
"Doesn't he remind you of Dwight Carson?"
"Oh, forget Dwight Carson."
Winan's voice, refusing earnestness, refusing guilt, had sounded exactly like the voice that had said, "Forget the Stoddard Temple."
The secretary in the reception room looked, startled, at the patrician gentleman whose face she had seen so often in the papers.
"Gail Winant," he said, inclining his head in self-introduction. "I should like to see Mr. Rourke. If he is not busy, please do not disturb him if he is. I had no appointment."
She had never expected Winant to come to an office unannounced, and to ask admittance in that tone of grave deference. She announced the visitor. Rourke came out into the reception room, smiling as if he found nothing unusual in this call.
"Hello, Gail. Come in."
"Hello, Howard."
He followed Rourke to the office. Beyond the broad windows, the darkness of late afternoon dissolved the city. It was snowing. Black specks whirled furiously across the lights.
"I don't want to interrupt if you're busy, Howard. This is not important."
He had not seen Rourke for 5 days since the dinner.
"I'm not busy." "Take your coat off. Shall I have the drawings brought in?"
"No, I don't want to talk about the house." "Actually, I came without any reason at all. I was down at my office all day, got slightly sick of it, and felt like coming here." "What are you grinning about?"
"Nothing. Only you said that it wasn't important."
Winant looked at him, smiled, and nodded.
He sat down on the edge of Rourke's desk, with an ease which he had never felt in his own office, his hands in his pockets, one leg swinging.
"It's almost useless to talk to you, Howard. I always feel as if I were reading to you a carbon copy of myself, and you've already seen the original. You seem to hear everything I say a minute in advance. We're unsynchronized."
"You call that unsynchronized?"
"All right. Too well synchronized."
His eyes were moving slowly over the room.
"If we own the things to which we say yes, then I own this office?"
"Then you own it."
"You know what I feel here? No, I won't say I feel at home. I don't think I've ever felt at home anywhere. And I won't say I feel as I did in the palaces I visited, or in the great European cathedrals. I feel as I did when I was still in Hell's Kitchen, in the best days I had there. There weren't many. But sometimes, when I sat like this, only it was some piece of broken wall by the wharf, and there were a lot of stars above and dump heaps around me, and the river smelt of rotting shells. Howard, when you look back, does it seem to you as if all your days had rolled forward evenly, like a sort of typing exercise, all alike? Or were there stops, points reached, and then the typing rolled on again?"
"There were stops."
"Did you know them at the time? Did you know that that's what they were?"
"Yes."
"I didn't. I knew afterward. But I never knew the reasons. There was one moment. I was 12 and I stood behind a wall, waiting to be killed. Only I knew I wouldn't be killed. Not what I did afterward, not the fight I had. But just that one moment when I waited. I don't know why that was a stop to be remembered, or why I feel proud of it. I don't know why I have to think of it here."
"Don't look for the reason."
"Do you know it?"
"I said don't look for it."
"I've been thinking about my past ever since I met you, and I had gone for years without thinking of it. No, no secret conclusions for you to draw from that. It doesn't hurt me to look back this way, and it doesn't give me pleasure. It's just looking. Not a quest, not even a journey. Just a kind of walk at random, like wandering through the countryside in the evening, when one's a little tired. If there's any connection to you at all, it's only one thought that keeps coming back to me. I keep thinking that you and I started in the same way. From the same point, from nothing. I just think that, without any comment. I don't seem to find any particular meaning in it at all. Just, we started in the same way. Want to tell me what it means?"
"No."
Winant glanced about the room and noticed a newspaper on top of a filing cabinet.
"Who the hell reads the Banner around here?"
"I do."
"Since when?"
since about a month ago.
Sadism?
No, just curiosity.
Wynand rose, picked up the paper, and glanced through the pages. He stopped at one and chuckled. He held it up. The page bore photographed drawings of the buildings for the March of the Centuries exposition.
Awful, isn't it? Said Wynand. It's disgusting that we have to plug that stuff. But I feel better about it when I think of what you did to those eminent civic leaders.
He chuckled happily.
You told them you don't cooperate or collaborate.
But it wasn't a gesture, Gale. It was plain common sense.
One can't collaborate on one's own job. I can cooperate, if that's what they call it, with the workers who erect my buildings, but I can't help them to lay bricks, and they can't help me to design the house. It was the kind of gesture I'd like to make. I'm forced to give those civic leaders free space in my papers, but it's all right. You've slapped their faces for me.
He tossed the paper aside, without anger.
It's like that luncheon I had to attend today, a national convention of advertisers. I must give them publicity. All wiggling, wriggling, and drooling. I got so sick of it I thought I'd run amok and bash somebody's skull. And then I thought of you. I thought that you weren't touched by any of it. Not in any way. The National Convention of Advertisers doesn't exist as far as you're concerned. It's in some sort of fourth dimension that can never establish any communication with you at all. I thought of that, and I felt a peculiar kind of relief.
He leaned against the filing cabinet, letting his feet slide forward, his arms crossed, and he spoke softly.
Howard, I had a kitten once. The damn thing attached itself to me, a flea-bitten little beast from the gutter, just fur, mud, and bones. Followed me home, I fed it and kicked it out. But the next day there it was again, and finally I kept it. I was 17 then, working for the Gazette, just learning to work in the special way I had to learn for life. I could take it all right, but not all of it. There were times when it was pretty bad, evenings usually. Once I wanted to kill myself. Not anger. Anger made me work harder. Not fear, but disgust, Howard. The kind of disgust that made it seem as if the whole world were under water and the water stood still. Water that had backed up out of the sewers and ate into everything, even the sky, even my brain. And then I looked at that kitten, and I thought that it didn't know the things I loathed. It could never know. It was clean. Clean in the absolute sense, because it had no capacity to conceive of the world's ugliness. I can't tell you what relief there was in trying to imagine the state of consciousness inside that little brain, trying to share it. A living consciousness, but clean and free. I would lie down on the floor and put my face on that cat's belly and hear the beast purring. And then I would feel better. There, Howard, I've called your office a rotting wharf and yourself an alley cat. That's my way of paying homage.
Rourke smiled. Wynand saw that the smile was grateful.
Keep still, Wynand said sharply. Don't say anything.
He walked to a window and stood looking out.
I don't know why in hell I should speak like that. These are the first happy years of my life. I met you because I wanted to build a monument to my happiness. I come here to find rest, and I find it, and yet these are the things I talk about. Well, never mind. Look at the filthy weather. Are you through with your work here? Can you call it a day?
Yes, just about.
Let's go and have dinner together somewhere close by.
All right.
May I use your phone? I'll tell Dominique not to expect me for dinner.
He dialed the number. Rourke moved to the door of the drafting room. He had orders to give before leaving. But he stopped at the door. He had to stop and hear it.
Hello, Dominique?
Yes.
Tired? No, you just sounded like it. I won't be home for dinner. Will you excuse me, dearest? I don't know, I might be late. I'm eating downtown. No, I'm having dinner with Howard Rourke. Hello, Dominique? Yes. I'm calling from his office. So long, dear.
He replaced the receiver. In the library of the penthouse, Dominique stood with her hand on the telephone, as if some connection still remained. For 5 days and nights, she had fought a single desire. To go to him. To see him alone, anywhere, his home or his office or the street, for one word or only one glance.
but alone. She could not go. Her share of action was ended. He would come to her when he wished. She knew he would come, and that he wanted her to wait. She had waited. But she had held on to one thought, of an address, an office in the Cord building. She stood, her hand closed over the stem of the telephone receiver. She had no right to go to that office. But Gail Winand had. When Ellsworth Toohey entered Winand's office as summoned, he made a few steps, then stopped. The walls of Winand's office, the only luxurious room in the Banner building, were made of cork and copper paneling, and had never borne any pictures. Now, on the wall facing Winand's desk, he saw an enlarged photograph under glass. The picture of Rourke at the opening of the Enright House. Rourke standing at the parapet of the river, his head thrown back. Toohey turned to Winand. They looked at each other. Winand indicated a chair, and Toohey sat down. Winand spoke, smiling. "I never thought I would come to agree with some of your social theories, Mr. Toohey, but I find myself forced to do so. You have always denounced the hypocrisy of the upper caste and preached the virtue of the masses, and now I find that I regret the advantages I enjoyed in my former proletarian state. Were I still in Hell's Kitchen, I would have begun this interview by saying, 'Listen, louse,' but since I am an inhibited capitalist, I shall not do so." Toohey waited. He looked curious. "I shall begin by saying, 'Listen, Mr. Toohey, I do not know what makes you tick. I do not care to dissect your motives. I do not have the stomach required of medical students. So I shall ask no questions, and I wish to hear no explanations. I shall merely tell you that from now on there is a name you will never mention in your column again.'" He pointed to the photograph. "I could make you reverse yourself publicly, and I would enjoy it. But I prefer to forbid the subject to you entirely. Not a word, Mr. Toohey. Not ever again. Now don't mention your contract or any particular clause of it. It would not be advisable. Go on writing your column. But remember its title, and devote it to commensurate subjects. Keep it small, Mr. Toohey. Very small."
"Yes, Mr. Winand," said Toohey easily. "I don't have to write about Mr. Rourke at present."
"That's all." Toohey rose.
"Yes, Mr. Winand.
Chapter 5. Gail Winand sat at his desk in his office and read the proofs of an editorial on the moral value of raising large families. Sentences like used chewing gum, chewed and re-chewed, spat out and picked up again, passed from mouth to mouth to pavement to shoe sole to mouth to brain. He thought of Howard Rourke, and went on reading the Banner. It made things easier. Daintiness is a girl's greatest asset. Be sure to launder your undies every night, and learn to talk on some cultured subject, and you will have all the dates you want. Your horoscope for tomorrow shows a beneficent aspect. Application and sincerity will bring rewards in the fields of engineering, public accounting, and romance. Mrs. Huntington Cole's hobbies are gardening, the opera, and early American sugar bowls. She divides her time between her little son, Kit, and her numerous charitable activities.
I'm just Millie. I'm just an orphan.
For the complete diet, send 10 cents in a self-addressed stamped envelope. He turned the pages, thinking of Howard Rourke. He signed the advertising contract with Cremo Pudding for 5 years on the entire Winand chain, 2 full pages in every paper every Sunday. The men before his desk sat like triumphal arches in flesh, monuments to victory, to evenings of patience and calculation, restaurant tables, glasses emptied into throats, months of thought, his energy, his living energy flowing like the liquid in the glasses into the opening of heavy lips, into stubby fingers, across a desk, into 2 full pages every Sunday, into drawings of yellow molds trimmed with strawberries and yellow molds trimmed with butterscotch sauce. He looked over the heads of the men at the photograph on the wall of his office. The sky, the river, and a man's face lifted. "But it hurts me," he thought. "It hurts me every time I think of him. It makes everything easier, the people, the editorials, the contracts, but easier because it hurts so much. Pain is a stimulant also. I think I hate that name. I will go on repeating it. It is a pain I wish to bear." Then he sat facing Rourke in the study of his penthouse, and he felt no pain.
only a desire to laugh without malice.
Howard, everything you've done in your life is wrong according to the stated ideals of mankind. And here you are, and somehow it seems a huge joke on the whole world.
Rourke sat in an armchair by the fireplace. The glow of the fire moved over the study. The light seemed to curve with conscious pleasure about every object in the room, proud to stress its beauty, stamping approval upon the taste of the man who had achieved this setting for himself. They were alone. Dominique had excused herself after dinner. She had known that they wanted to be alone.
"A joke on all of us," said Wynand, "on every man in the street. I always look at the men in the street. I used to ride in the subways just to see how many of them carried the banner. I used to hate them, and sometimes to be afraid. But now I look at every one of them, and I want to say, why, you poor fool. That's all."
He telephoned Rourke's office one morning.
"Can you have lunch with me, Howard? Meet me at the Nordland in half an hour."
He shrugged, smiling, when he faced Rourke across the restaurant table.
"Nothing at all, Howard. No special reason. Just been a revolting half hour and wanted to take the taste of it out of my mouth."
"What revolting half hour?"
"Had my picture taken with Lancelot Clokey."
"Who's Lancelot Clokey?" Wynand laughed aloud, forgetting his controlled elegance, forgetting the startled glance of the waiter.
"That's it, Howard. That's why I had to have lunch with you. Because you can say things like that."
"Now what's the matter?"
"Don't you read books? Don't you know that Lancelot Clokey is our most sensitive observer of the international scene? That's what the critics said, in my own banner. Lancelot Clokey has just been chosen author of the year or something by some organization or other. We're running his biography in the Sunday Supplement. And I had to pose with my arm around his shoulders. He wears silk shirts and smells of gin. His second book is about his childhood and how it helped him to understand the international scene. It sold 100,000 copies. But you've never heard of him. Go on, eat your lunch, Howard. I like to see you eating. I wish you were broke so that I could feed you this lunch and know you really needed it."
At the end of the day, he would come unannounced to Rourke's office or to his home. Rourke had an apartment in the Enright House, one of the crystal-shaped units over the East River, a workroom, a library, a bedroom. He had designed the furniture himself. Wynand could not understand for a long time why the place gave him an impression of luxury, until he saw that one did not notice the furniture at all. Only a clean sweep of space, and the luxury of an austerity that had not been simple to achieve. In financial value, it was the most modest home that Wynand had entered as a guest in 25 years.
"We started in the same way, Howard," he said, glancing about Rourke's room. "According to my judgment and experience, you should have remained in the gutter. But you haven't. I like this room. I like to sit here.
I like to see you here."
"Howard, have you ever held power over a single human being?"
"No. And I wouldn't take it if it were offered to me."
"I can't believe that."
"It was offered to me once, Gale. I refused it." Wynand looked at him with curiosity. It was the first time that he heard effort in Rourke's voice.
"Why?"
"I had to."
"Out of respect for the man?"
"It was a woman."
"Oh, you damn fool. Out of respect for a woman?"
"Out of respect for myself."
"Don't expect me to understand. We're as opposite as two men can be."
"I thought that once. I wanted to think that."
"And now you don't?"
"No."
"Don't you despise every act I've ever committed?"
"Just about everyone I know of."
"And you still like to see me here?"
"Yes."
"Gale, there was a man who considered you the symbol of the special evil that destroyed him and would destroy me. He left me his hatred."
"And there was another reason."
"I think I hated you before I saw you." "I knew you did." "What made you change your mind?"
"I can't explain that to you." They drove together to the estate in Connecticut where the walls of the house were rising out of the frozen ground. Wynand followed Rourke through the future rooms. He stood aside and watched Rourke giving instructions. Sometimes Wynand came alone. The workers saw the black roadster twisting up the road to the top of the hill, saw Wynand's figure standing at a distance looking at the structure. His figure always carried with it all the implications of his position.
the quiet elegance of his overcoat, the angle of his hat, the confidence of his posture, tense and casual together, made one think of the Winand Empire, of the presses thundering from ocean to ocean, of the papers, the lustrous magazine covers, the light rays trembling through newsreels, the wires coiling over the world, the power flowing into every palace, every capital, every secret, crucial room, day and night, through every costly minute of this man's life. He stood still against a sky gray as laundry water, and snowflakes fluttered lazily past the brim of his hat. On a day in April, he drove alone to Connecticut after an absence of many weeks. The roadster flew across the countryside, not an object, but a long streak of speed. He felt no jolting motion inside his small cube of glass and leather. It seemed to him that his car stood still, suspended over the ground, while the control of his hands on the wheel made the earth fly past him. And he merely had to wait until the place he desired came rolling to him. He loved the wheel of a car as he loved his desk in the office of the Banner. Both gave him the same sense of a dangerous monster let loose under the expert direction of his fingers. Something tore past across his vision, and he was a mile away before he thought how strange it was that he should have noticed it, because it had been only a clump of weeds by the road. A mile later, he realized that it was stranger still. The weeds were green. Not in the middle of winter, he thought. And then he understood, surprised, that it was not winter any longer. He had been very busy in the last few weeks. He had not had time to notice. Now he saw it, hanging over the fields around him, a hint of green, like a whisper. He heard three statements in his mind in precise succession, like interlocking gears. It's spring. I wonder if I have many left to see. I am 55 years old. They were statements, not emotions. He felt nothing, neither eagerness nor fear. But he knew it was strange that he should experience a sense of time. He had never thought of his age in relation to any measure. He had never defined his position on a limited course. He had not thought of a course, nor of limits. He had been Gale Winand, and he had stood still like this car, and the years had sped past him like this earth, and the motor within him had controlled the flight of the years. No, he thought, I regret nothing. There have been things I missed, but I ask no questions because I have loved it, such as it has been. Even the moments of emptiness. Even the unanswered. And that I loved it. That is the unanswered in my life. But I loved it. If it were true, that old legend about appearing before a supreme judge and naming one's record, I would offer with all my pride not any act I committed, but one thing I have never done on this earth, that I never sought an outside sanction. I would stand and say, I am Gale Winand, the man who has committed every crime, except the foremost one, that of ascribing futility to the wonderful fact of existence and seeking justification beyond myself. This is my pride, but now, thinking of the end, I do not cry like all the men of my age. But what was the use and the meaning? I was the use and the meaning, I, Gale Winand, that I lived and that I acted. He drove to the foot of the hill and slammed the brakes on, startled, looking up. In his absence, the house had taken shape. It could be recognized now. It looked just like the drawing. He felt a moment of childish wonder that it had really come out just as on the sketch, as if he had never quite believed it. Rising against the pale blue sky, it still looked like a drawing, unfinished, the planes of masonry like spreads of watercolor filled in, the naked scaffolding like pencil lines, a huge drawing on a pale blue sheet of paper. He left the car and walked to the top of the hill. He saw Rourke among the men. He stood outside and watched the way Rourke walked through the structure, the way he turned his head or raised his hand, pointing. He noticed Rourke's manner of stopping, his legs apart, his arms straight at his sides, his head lifted. An instinctive pose of confidence, of energy held under effortless control. A moment that gave to his body the structural cleanliness of his own building. Structure, thought Winand, is a solved problem of tension, of balance, of security in counterthrusts. He thought, there's no emotional significance in the act of erecting a building.
It's just a mechanical job, like laying sewers or making an automobile. And he wondered why he watched Rourke feeling what he felt in his art gallery. He belongs in an unfinished building, thought Winant, more than in a completed one. More than at a drafting table. It's his right setting. It's becoming to him. As Dominique said, a yacht was becoming to me. Afterward, Rourke came out, and they walked together along the crest of the hill among the trees. They sat down on a fallen tree trunk. They saw the structure in the distance, through the stems of the brushwood. The stems were dry and naked, but there was a quality of spring in the cheerful insolence of their upward thrust, the stirring of a self-assertive purpose. Winand asked, "Howard, have you ever been in love?" Rourke turned to look straight at him, and answer quietly, "I still am." "But when you walk through a building, what you feel is greater than that?" "Much greater, Gale. I was thinking of people who say that happiness is impossible on earth. Look how hard they all try to find some joy in life. Look how they struggle for it. Why should any living creature exist in pain? By what conceivable right can anyone demand that a human being exist for anything but for his own joy? Every one of them wants it. Every part of him wants it. But they never find it. I wonder why. They whine and say they don't understand the meaning of life. There's a particular kind of people that I despise, those who seek some sort of a higher purpose or universal goal, who don't know what to live for, who moan that they must find themselves. You hear it all around us. That seems to be the official bromide of our century, every book you open, every drooling self-confession. It seems to be the noble thing to confess. I'd think it would be the most shameful one. Look, Gale. Rourke got up, reached out, tore a thick branch off a tree, held it in both hands, one fist closed at each end. Then his wrists and knuckles tensed against the resistance. He bent the branch slowly into an arc. Now I can make what I want of it. A bow, a spear, a cane, a railing. That's the meaning of life. Your strength? Your work. He tossed the branch aside. The material the earth offers you, and what you make of it. What are you thinking of, Gale? The photograph on the wall of my office. To remain controlled as he wished, to be patient, to make of patience an active duty executed consciously each day, to stand before Rourke and let her serenity tell him, "This is the hardest you could have demanded of me, but I'm glad, if it's what you want." Such was the discipline of Dominique's existence. She stood by as a quiet spectator of Rourke and Winand. She watched them silently. She had wanted to understand Winand. This was the answer. She accepted Rourke's visits to their house, and the knowledge that in the hours of these evenings he was Winand's property, not hers. She met him as a gracious hostess, indifferent and smiling, not a person, but an exquisite fixture of Winand's home. She presided at the dinner table. She left them in the study afterward. She sat alone in the drawing room with the lights turned off and the door open. She sat erect and quiet, her eyes on the slit of light under the door of the study across the hall. She thought, "This is my task,